much. It's time for us to connect with one of the amazing team of Cliff Decker Hofmeyr Inc. this morning, the turn of director Gavin Stansfield. Gavin, good morning and welcome.
Morning, Brad. Thanks very much.
Yeah, good to be connecting with you. Thanks also for opportunities to have conversations around these important topics. Let's be honest, for you, it's your bread and butter. For people on our side, sometimes you're just afraid to ask the question. Sometimes you just say yes and accept things that you shouldn't. And other times people kick up a fuss when actually they don't have a foot to stand on. So we're grateful for the truth that you share with us on a Monday morning. What's on this morning's menu?
I thought, Brad, we'd touch briefly on restraint of trade.
Yeah, let's chat a little bit about that. So are you suggesting then maybe if I were to walk out of here at the end of my contract, they could say to me, well, you can't work any other radio station or something similar?
Well, let me ask you a question. Have you signed a contract which says that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, then you're fine.
Okay.
Well, I suppose we can end the call now.
And for many, that's a bit of a confusing point because they're saying, well, this is where I live and this is where I operate from. Can I not even work here again in my field of expertise?
Yeah, that's the argument, isn't it? So let's start and try and dispel a couple of misnomers about the restraint of trade. The first thing is, and obviously, I mean, let's just start with the basic proposition that you need, as an employer, if you are trying to enforce a restraint, the first thing you need is you need a signed document, okay? When I say that, you need a contract. Restraint of trade, we talk about rights which have their basis or their origin in the law of contract. So in other words, if you don't have a contract as the employer, or if you haven't signed a contract as an employee in terms of which you have provided certain post-termination contractual obligations, i.e. restraint of trade, well, then this discussion doesn't apply to you. But I'm sure there are many of you listening who maybe you have signed a restraint in some other form, and maybe you'd be checking your contract again if you haven't read it for a while to see if you have and to see what it says. But if you have signed such an agreement, the first misnomer often said around the dinner table is that, well, restraints of trade are not worth the paper that they're written on, so you can forget about it. It's not enforceable. I'm here to tell you in clear and unequivocal terms that that view is most certainly incorrect. Restraints are very much enforceable. Of course, there's a lot of law which surrounds their enforceability, and maybe that's the basis upon which the misnomer arises. But the important part is that within South African law, the Supreme Court of Appeal, in fact, the old appellate division in 1984, in a landmark case in restraint of trade called Magna Alloys, said that a contract is a contract, and a contract must be enforced between two parties unless you can escape the provisions and the enforceability of the contract through something which is contra bonis mores, in other words, unreasonable and therefore contrary to public policy. And then, of course, the onus is on the party who wishes to escape the contract to prove that it is unreasonable and accordingly contra bonis mores or contrary to public policy. So the starting point, Brad, is that if you've signed a restraint of trade agreement, if you leave the employer of your employer and the employer seeks to enforce it against you, the starting point that you must understand is that the contract is valid and it's binding. And if you want to show that it's not valid and not binding on you, you as the employee bear the onus in law of proving that the contract is unreasonable and accordingly it is against public policy. That's the very important first thing I need to tell you. Yes, I'll let you come in there.
Yeah, it's just talking about restraint of trade, for people wondering, what is the purpose of it? You know, if I were to be employed somewhere along the line and I now need to move on or want to move on somewhere, I can't work within a particular area. People might be asking, but why not? I mean, why couldn't I go and join the competitor? So it does help for people saying, well, why on earth would someone stop me from doing what I do at another place? Surely I have a right to work where I want to. So just to help people understand, why would there be a restraint of trade contractually binding?
That leads very nicely into the second part of the discussion. That is all right, fine. Let's look at reasonableness. If the assumption is the contract is binding, what does reasonableness mean? So the first test in reasonableness is there a protectable interest deserving of, or an interest that is deserving of protection on the part of the employer? And that is broken down very briefly into two main categories. That's trade secrets, which is otherwise known as confidential information, and trade connections, which is otherwise known as the relationships that the company has between its with its clients, with its suppliers, and whomever else. And those are generally regarded as the two categories of which an employer is able to assert some form of protection that says that, all right, fine, if you're going to come and work for me, I'm going to expose you to the business and you are going to be the front person, the salesperson. You're going to have the opportunity of forging relationships with my clients, such as that if you ever leave one day, you have the capacity to induce or persuade the client to leave me and go to you. That is very much a protectable interest in law. And if you can make out such a protectable interest, and if you have an appropriately worded restraint of trade document that says for a certain period of time after you leave and within a certain area, you cannot solicit, entice, persuade any of my clients to go with you, 100% enforceable, Brad, and you know, a very good example of why you would seek to restrain someone post the termination of their employment.
Yeah, and particularly if you know exactly which the 11 herbs and spices are, there's no way you'll be allowed to tell or go and open your own chicken franchise.
Leads very nicely into the point about trade secrets, and that's confidential information. Mm. Because, of course, I've spoken about relationships, but, of course, where you are as a consequence of your employment, where I expose you to what I regard as my trade secrets or my confidential information, my know-how, my recipes. I mean, the example that you give is a good one.
Yeah.
Then it's clear that I can stop you for a period of time after you leave me from going to work for a competitor through the fear that you're going to take the recipe with you, even if you carry it away with you in your head. I don't have to prove that you downloaded it onto a flash drive or that you've emailed it to your Gmail address. If you know it, if you have this knowledge, if you've had access to my confidential information, and you can take it away with you, even in your head, it's a problem. And I can seek, I can stop you from working for a competitor for a certain period of time. How long that period of time might be is going to depend, of course, on the nature of the information and how quickly the information changes.
This seems like a question a bit like how long is a piece of string, but I mean, what is reasonable in a contract? I guess it depends on where you work and what information you're proxy to, but you know, what would be a reasonable suggestion on strength of trade?
Good question. So when we talk about the duration of restraint periods, generally the sort of the marker that goes down in the sand is 12 months. I mean, if we're going to generalize, however, there are instances where, for example, if you are working in the off-quoted IT industry, for example, where things are changing rapidly, the nature of confidential information is changing over a very fast period of time. You know, maybe 6 months is appropriate. If you're talking about a recipe, for example, which never changes, Coca-Cola is Coca-Cola and KFC is KFC. Presumably, they haven't changed their 11 secret herbs and spices for a long time, and that's the point. Well, then I can seek to protect you in perpetuity against utilizing or filching that information and utilize it in competition. So it really, I agree, how long is a piece of string? It depends entirely on the nature of the case, the nature of the circumstances, and, of course, the type of information that it is that you're trying to protect. But in essence, a relationship, for example, just to come back to trade connections, it's generally regarded that 12 months is a sufficient period of time if you bring about a break in that relationship between your erstwhile employee and your customer. You put a new salesperson in there and you allow them to establish the relationship. 12 months is generally regarded by the courts as an appropriate and fair period of time.
Is there ever a point at which there's an unfair dismissal for whatever reason and then there is no restraint of trade, or does that remain intact irrespective of the termination?
You know, you've got all the questions lined up, haven't you? I'm impressed. And I only gave to the listeners, I only gave Brad a topic this morning, so I'm very impressed. So Brad, the short answer there quickly is, generally speaking, no. Even if you unfairly dismiss someone, it does not necessarily impact on the enforceability of the restraint. In other words, even if you are unfairly dismissed, you remain bound by your restraint of trade obligations. And the very quick thinking there is that, you know, the fairness or otherwise of dismissal shouldn't impact on your right as an employer to protect your trade secrets or your trade connections. If you have a problem with your dismissal, you have a remedy for that, and you must pursue your unfair dismissal remedies in terms of the LRA.
Yeah, so irrespective of how the relationship is ended, if you've got one of those clauses in place, the choice for you is to go and work in another industry, work in another city. I mean, it leaves you in a difficult situation if for whatever reason you need to move on.
Look, not necessarily, Brad. And I don't want to send out that message that it's so draconian that that you must go and work in another city, because it's not. But if you get proper advice on it, you will often find that there are a number of alternatives or alternatives for you which would not amount to a breach of your restraint without having to uproot yourself and your family. You must just get proper advice, and you must seek to conduct yourself in a way that gives adequate protection to your previous employer's protectable interests, whatever they may be. It's something that beyond the course of our time and something that you need specialist advice. But it's not intended to uproot people and, you know, and render them economically inactive. Nice. That obviously, if that is the outcome and if that is the cause, then that feeds into the employee's argument that this is unreasonable and contrary to public policy and therefore shouldn't be enforced. So that's really where the balance lies.
Yeah, great conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed that. Gavin Stansfield, Director of Employment Law at Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr. Thank you for your time this morning. Thanks for we're always thorough, and I'm always left as a layperson having complete understanding of the basics of something. So thanks so much for explaining that so well.
You're most welcome, Brad, anytime.
Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye. So that's Gavin Stansfield from Cliff Dekker Hofmeyr Inc. And as always, your questions are open to be discussed. I mean, here you've got some of the top legal minds, labor law legal minds in the country at their big office here in the CBD of Cape.